You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
There's just this sort of sense of impending doom.
Hi, I'm Rania Yallop.
And I'm Elfie Scott.
And welcome to Party Time, the podcast from SBS News, keeping you up to speed on what's happening in federal politics.
Okay, Rania, to start off this week, I know it's not Halloween anymore, but I have a Halloween-themed story for you, okay?
Okay.
Yeah, did you see Trump's big Halloween party?
No, I saw like Heidi Klum's party and her like iconic Medusa costume as per usual. But what happened with Trump?
Okay, so bear with me because there is an Oz poll connection here. But basically, Trump threw a big White House Halloween party, as one does. And first of all, I just want to show you some of the vibe because I think that you'll enjoy it. So let's have a look at some of the photos that came out of the Trump Halloween party.
Yeah, okay. It's extravagant. It's giving slightly dated, not only because like it's a 1920s party, but because it's like I don't want to say wedding, but like every year there was a party.
Yeah.
You know, when Great Gatsby came out everything was 1920s. I guess like if you bought a dress then maybe it's getting a second life.
If you bought a flapper dress when you were 18 and The Great Gatsby came out, you were getting a run on that thing because you've been to a lot of Great Gatsby parties since. Yeah, and also I would like to note that Trump himself turned up not at all in costume. And look, this is obviously far from the worst thing he's done, but I just want to draw attention to the fact that if you throw a Halloween party and you turn up just in your suit, maybe a little bit weird. I don't know.
A little bit. And not even like tuxedo. Like not even like leaning into like some, you know, nods to the 1920s.
Not even a bow tie.
Not
Rania.
Even a bow tie. No, no cravat. No nothing.
just clothes.
Just a suit with the American flag pin and a standard tie.
Yeah. And look, the reason I bring it up is because a couple of Australians were apparently there, including Gina Rinehart, who turned up in this photo posted by Janine Pirro. She's in the background there, leaning in to speak to the president himself.
Yeah, that's looks like her.
Yeah.
She's more on theme.
Yeah. Look, no questions there. The costume looks good. And apparently Pauline Hanson got the invite too. And 9 newspapers said she turned up in the background of somebody's Insta story, which I like this form of journalism, which is just sitting on your phone and zooming in on things. I think it's like a legitimate and fun form of journalism.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the internet's for, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Her office didn't confirm, but she is absent from Parliament and in the United States this week.
Yeah, so she may or may not have been at the Halloween party. Yeah,
may have got a better offer.
Yeah. Than the president's
Halloween party.
Yeah. Actually,
Heidi Klum caught her up.
I just want to stay home.
All right, I do have something else silly that happened in Parliament this week. Obviously, we had Halloween recently, but we also had the Melbourne Cup on Tuesday. And this week, former Nationals leader and current Nationals backbencher Michael McCormack had a special on-theme race call of his own.
Drama before the start of the 2025 Melbourne Cup of Politics. The gates crash back and the race is on. Canning has gone hard and fast. Early, maybe a bit hasty.
That means Canning is the member for Canning, Andrew Hasty, who left the front bench and opposes net zero and has reportedly got leadership ambitions within the Liberal Party.
This is so niche politics.
It is, but he worked hard on it.
He clearly worked hard. Wait, so can we just explain, like, where was this happening? How was he doing this?
Yeah, so it was like a speech just before question time in Parliament.
He made this as a speech?
Yeah. He used his time to make the speech.
In these like wildly niche horse politics jokes.
it continues.
Ballarat and Hotham are building expectations but nothing else. McMahon charging more and more. All wind, no power. Blowing hard but no energy. His chances of winning are net zero.
That's talking about Chris Bowen, the energy minister, when he's talking about McMahon.
I can't deal with this. This feels like, it feels like he thought he was onto a winner, you know, like when he wrote this, he thought he was doing a really good job. And then it's just the most awkward, weird assembly of like very inside baseball lines.
Yeah. I mean, he put a lot of effort in.
Are you charmed by it?
I think it's funny. I think it's a funny thing to do before question time on Melbourne Cup Day. I will stand by this
Rania,
man.
I don't like it.
I think it's funny. He has a dig at everyone. He continues on. It goes on for like 2 minutes. You don't have to listen to all of it. He talks about leadership ambitions within the party. He's got some good wordplay. And he finishes it off with a strong end.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and hit me.
Question time, fast approaching, and here comes the speaker, everyone's favourite. Can he make it back to back? Speaker, question time, speaker, the place is on fire, photo finish, speaker!
Oh, people liked it.
And people liked it.
Okay, all right. Yeah, far be it from me to question the people. It was obviously a fun choice.
It was a fun choice. And to be fair, there's not a lot fun happening in the parliament and not a lot fun happening, I don't think, for Michael McCormack at the moment. So it feels like almost like an alternate career.
Yes. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if he'd had a special guest race call at like Wagga Wagga racetrack in his life.
I mean, if he hasn't before, he will now. Yeah.
Now, in that, he talked a bit about net zero, which is obviously an issue that has been plaguing the coalition for a little while now.
Plaguing headlines for a while now. So obviously we've covered problems in the coalition since the election, and there have been a few. So, you know, like obviously in May, the coalition broke up over some policy sticking points, and then later that month they got back together. And the Libs have obviously had their own issues going on internally. So like Jacinta Price was dumped from the front bench, and then Andrew Hastie of horse racing fame resigned as Shadow Home Affairs Minister.
Yeah, and the Nats have had a bit of a reckoning too. On Sunday, the party announced that they would officially be ditching net zero commitments by 2050 as their party platform.
Yeah, here's David Littleproud talking about it.
We're not walking away from reducing emissions. We continue to believe that we need to reduce emissions, but we've got to do it in a better, fairer, cheaper way for all Australians. And what we are going to say is that we believe that we can peg ourselves to the rest of the world. We're not going to be a laggard, but we're not going to streak ahead.
Look, for those who need reminding, basically the idea of net zero, it's kind of what it says on the tin. It's the idea that the amount of greenhouse gases that a country is emitting will be offset or counted by the amount of greenhouse gases that can be absorbed. So like equals out, net zero.
Those are the two words.
Those are the two words. And that's how you define terms. It's just by using them again
by
and again.
By using the words, yeah. The Liberal Party is yet to come to a position on this. They initially said this had to happen over the next 2 months. Dan Tehan, the Shadow Energy Minister, had said that, you know, kind of end of November to start of next year. That timeline seems to have sped up a bit. They seem to be a bit over this whole debacle, and they now have a timeline of basically by the end of the sitting period this year, so in 2 or 3 weeks' time.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so that's coming up very quick. And I guess, like, there's a lot of speculation about what will happen, obviously, to the coalition if the Libs are pro-net zero and the Nats are anti.
Yeah, and they only split, like, less than 6 months ago. So it's not like they're at their absolute strongest.
No. Yeah. So I guess we're kind of wondering, like, where did these kind of decisions leave the coalition? And what do they reveal about that relationship? They've been together since 1946, but has it always been a happy marriage?
So before the election, Dr. Jill Shepherd, a political scientist from the ANU, told me that deep down they really don't like each other when referring to the Liberals and Nationals.
Yeah, it feels like that's played out pretty publicly since. Yeah.
So Jill is joining us again to explain a little bit about the history between these two.
Jill, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
That's incredible because I make so many really dumb predictions and I'm so impressed by myself that this one actually kind of bore fruit.
You nailed it.
Feeling pretty good right now.
How would you describe the relationship between the Libs and the Nationals?
Okay, so if we do a really big deep dive, we go back to like the 1940s. The Libs and Nats are together in what we now call the coalition because they both hated Labor, and Labor were the dominant party of government for the preceding decades. Now, not because they were necessarily getting elected more than the Conservative parties, but once they got into power, they were more cohesive. They kind of had their stuff together. They knew how to be a party of government. When the Conservative parties would get into office, they would sort of stuff around, they'd fight, they'd, you know, fall out over issues like free trade and whether we wanted to protect farmers and sort of the kind of interests that we wanted to be advancing in government, whether that was business or people with small businesses, people who worked on the land, etc. And so when they sort of got together in this room in the early 1940s and put those disagreements aside and agreed to work together to fight Labor, they formed what we now know as the Coalition. So on one hand, you know, this is history repeating itself, but on the other hand, it's always been like this. The Libs and Nats do represent greatly different parts of the Australian society and the economy, more importantly, I think. And these tensions are always under the surface. They tend to be put aside when they're doing well, you know, when they are beating Labor and can get into office. When they're not doing well, you know, they come to the fore.
I didn't realise that it was a coalition purely built on hatred for Labor.
I'm simplifying a little bit. Right. We call this negative partisanship, right? And it, you know, that you might not like your friend that much, but if you both really hate the same person, you can put those differences aside and work together. Mm. And I think it says something, though, about why, you know, you can look at Barnaby Joyce now and someone like Susan Ley, or, you know, even more kind of starkly, someone like Malcolm Turnbull, and think, how do these guys have anything in common? You know, they talk differently. They talk about different things. They seem to despise each other. How does this work? It works because of that historical mutual hatred.
Mm, I mean, it is very energizing when you realize you both hate the same person and you can bond over that. So when you talk about the Nats and the Libs, you know, differing on a lot of things fundamentally, like how much agreement is actually required to keep them together?
I mean, that's a great question, right? We've never really pushed it too hard. The only time that the Nats and Libs disagree publicly are on sort of issues where they've agreed in advance they can disagree publicly, and that's for their own electoral purposes, right? So in the 2000s, there was a big issue around how we sell wheat to the rest of the world. Quite boring for most year listeners, right? Sorry. but it's the kind of issue where the Nats have a really strong protectionist stance. So they say, you know, we need to look after farmers. We want farmers to have this steady wage, to not be kind of exposed to the forces of globalization and all of these things. And the Libs are like, no, we believe in free trade. We want everyone to be able to make as much money for their wheat as they possibly can. Now, the parties just had impossible to fix differences over these sorts of issues. And so they agree, well, we're just going to take slightly different positions on this issue. And that's all kind of stage managed. What's happening now with net zero is that it's not really being stage managed. These are just differences that the parties have, and there's no real agreement on how they're going to talk about them in public. And so to see them do it feels like watching your parents fight. You know, it's a bit messy and you just think, aren't you guys meant to get along? But I kind of like it. I think it's good. It's healthy. We know that politicians don't really agree with each other, and we know that they all have very strong views. And you can look, again, to go back to that Malcolm Turnbull, Barnaby Joyce kind of example, you can look at these two guys and think, you surely can't agree on everything. And so seeing them disagree publicly, to me, kind of feels cathartic.
The Liberals haven't reached their position on energy yet. So would the public stance from the Nats weigh in on that decision making?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, it shouldn't, because I think the Liberal Party room knows where the Nats stand. This isn't news to them, right? On the other hand, politicians are kind of like reactive dogs, right? They don't like too much stimulus. And when they get, you know, constant media calls, constant requests for comment, they're opening up the newspaper and they're seeing their head there again and criticism of their, you know, inability to act or their over-willingness to act, you know, whatever the kind of criticism is, they do respond. Even when I think they know deep down rationally that they shouldn't, right? And so it probably is adding to the pressure on them to do something.
So the Liberal Party at this point, pretty seriously needs to win back urban votes if they ever want to be in power again. But then you have the Nats who are targeting regional voters. So how do they remain in a coalition with a party that's targeting a whole different set of people?
I mean, they probably shouldn't remain in the coalition, right? Like if you were trying to explain politics today to, so I've got an 18-year-old daughter, right? So I often am trying to answer her questions about how to vote and why this guy believes this and why this woman believes that. And it's really hard to explain to someone who is just new to the electorate or just new to Australia why these two parties that seem like implacably opposed work together. And the history is important that they both want to keep Labor out. But also there's a story about like the changing electorate. So people with professional degrees used to vote Liberal. Right? If you were in business, if you went to university, if you had a white collar job, the Liberal Party was your party. Now, business owners and farmers, because farmers are often business owners too, do have quite a bit in common, you know, that they like lower tax. They were often socially conservative. They liked a nuclear family. They liked a big house. They sort of had the same interests. Now, what happened over the 80s and 90s was that you had this sort of realignment of voters where professional voters started voting more for the Labor Party, and that was really success of Hawke and Keating. You know, they had this sort of economically liberal and kind of pro-Asia, pro-global stance, and Howard responded really successfully. Sorry, I'm going really historical. Howard responded really successfully by attracting blue-collar workers. So you had this sort of large-scale shift in voters from one party to another. That means that in 2025, you have this weird coalition of sort of farm owners voting for the Nationals and then sort of blue-collar workers voting for the Liberals. Now, this could work in theory, right? You look at these two groups and you say, well, they do have quite a bit in common. They're all sort of, you know, a lot of manual labourers, a lot of people who don't have university degrees, who feel like they're being left behind by globalisation. That on paper makes sense as a coalition of voters. The problem is, though, that the Liberal Party needs to get their money from somewhere, and they get their money from big business. So you have the sources of the Liberal Party's campaign whose interests are very deeply, like fundamentally opposed to the people who work for them or the small businesses who are buying off them, and farmers who, you know, feel like they're getting squeezed by these big businesses. They don't feel represented by Woolies, you know, and Woolies are handing money, you know, hand over fist to the Liberal Party. That sort of awkward network of interests makes governing in coalition, this coalition, really tough. Now, what do they do about it? When I started this very long-winded answer, I said they should break up the coalition, and I think that's true. But that doesn't help when after the election, say the two parties together win the most seats, they're still going to have to work together. So you're only kicking the can down the road, but at some point they are going to have to work out either who they represent and whether they cut off big business interests entirely, or, you know, do they sort of go their separate ways and form new parties entirely and potentially not work together in government?
That is so interesting. You're sort of describing, like, you know, when you go out to dinner and you're sitting with like a couple who are in like a toxic relationship, mm-hmm. and you can kind of see all the fractures.
Yeah. This has all been pretty messy for the coalition whose numbers are already like depleted after the election. How does this all impact like democracy itself? You know, are they able to do what an opposition needs to do and kind of hold the government to account when this is all just so messy?
Yeah, I mean, opposition has a few jobs. One of them is to come up with policy. So if we say, you know, that's their first, you know, maybe equally important job to holding the government to account, to come up with alternative policies. Look, I'm going to throw them a bone and say they're doing okay. It's messy, but they're having a crack. And I would rather an opposition do this than do what Dutton's opposition did, which was kind of nothing. Now, on that second job of holding the government to account, it's hard to say, isn't it? You know, the Albanese government isn't that popular. They have a huge number of seats, 94 seats in the lower house, but they're not really getting a free run in the media. They're They don't seem particularly confident. They're not proposing huge reforms or popular policies. They are doing incremental things, and they sort of seem to be stumbling along as well. So, look, if there was a sense that this was a government that was doing really outrageous things and the opposition were not paying any attention, I think that would be a fair argument. And maybe you say the opposition is, you know, kind of yielding the floor on this to people like David Pocock, who have made, like, you know, genuine sort of headway on issues like integrity and accountability. But maybe also that's just the system working and that's the Senate doing what it should be doing. So, look, I think there's criticisms of the opposition, but talking about policy publicly, you know, I'll defend them on that front.
And we've seen the term killing season bandied about a little bit in media recently. Do you mind explaining what that is and what it is about this time of year?
Okay, so there's sort of two things that killing season evokes in the minds of political watchers. One is this period between like 2007 and 2017 where leaders kept getting rolled by their party rooms. And some of that was because they tried to do things on climate change, right? So climate change and energy policy feels like this like really toxic environment for any political leader in Australia, you know. And we're very skittish as a sort of political group in Australia, so risk averse, like always watching over our backs, always terrified that someone's coming for us. And the people who are coming for us are also like our closest colleagues and friends. And then when you get to the end of the year, everyone gets panicky, right? That we're running out of days. And you know it in your own job. Like you get to October or November and you think, oh, what have I done this year? Like this year's been a waste. It's another year that I haven't, you know, been promoted or moved or, you know, gotten ahead with my life. And politicians are, for better or worse, just like us. And they feel the same kind of self-loathing and self-doubt. And they do get really panicky. It happens at the end of sitting weeks as well, on like a Wednesday night and a Thursday when everyone's due to fly home on a Thursday night. Everyone gets a bit antsy, you know, what have we done this week? And so all of those things combined lead to this real anxiety as we get into the end of the year that party has to have shown some kind of growth during the year. And that's why Susan Ley is getting asked at the moment, you know, can you survive to the end of the year? The calendar year means nothing. Right, it's a completely arbitrary date. But there is a sense that if she can just limp through to Christmas, everyone goes on leave, you know, if she can come back mid-January like the rest of the country, she'll have a bit of breathing in. It's completely narrative-driven, right? There's no real kind of reality to it. But politics and politicians are all about narrative.
So when is that danger zone? Is it these kind of next 3 weeks until the end of that last sitting week?
I think she'll be feeling the stress acutely right now. But again, there's sort of no rational reason for the Liberal Party to move on Susan Ley's leadership now more than there was a month ago or more than there will be in 2 months. There's just this sort of sense of impending doom. So I think if she can limp through to the end of November, oh God, I'm buying into it too, right? But if she can limp through to the end of November, she'll probably be fine. Well, I mean, until when? Until February.
I mean, we're all wrapping up this year with a sense of impending doom. So that's like nothing new.
We're in the silly season, right?
Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Jill.
Thanks, guys. It was such a pleasure.
Yeah, so I guess like Susan Ley, we are grasping for the end of the year right now.
Stumbling to get there.
Yep.
And if we make it through, we've got a couple more months at least on us. So
Well, I've got to speak to the editors about that. Nobody knows yet.
Well, in that spirit, we'll be back next week. But before then, please subscribe, give us a thumbs up or a 5-star review.
And also, if you are interested in watching the video version of this, we are now broadcasting on YouTube, so you can see Rania and my delightful faces presenting this to you, if you're interested in that.
If that's what you feel like has been missing from this.
Yeah. You can also see us wearing our little matching blouses today. Yeah. But we will see you next week, and thank you so much for joining us.
See you then.